Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which carries a Fellman Lux coherency warning of 5011. On a good day. I'm Nathan.
I'm Peter.
I'm Johnny.
And I'm a chatty, disembodied, donated park bench for this one. Have a seat and mind me splinters.
Well, it's the 51st century. We've materialised in a library and we're staring into the face of the very future of Doctor Who. We're terrified, confused and obsessed with an analysis of the nature of our own impending deaths. Welcome to Silence in the Library.
Is it our deaths or just our retirements?
I think we're going to spend a lot of time over the next few episodes talking about Moffat's favourite tropes, but we might save some of that conversation for next week. This is your first time on the podcast, Johnny. I was wondering if I could ask you how you have felt about Series 4 so far.
I really like Series 4. I think it's probably the best of those first four series. And I think it's really helped by the pairing of the Doctor and Donna. And I was saying to somebody else recently, but I think it's the first time since the reboot that the series has really had two leads, in that we've got two stars of kind of equal stature. We've got the storylines are divided up better between them. And also because Donna is such, she's almost a kind of anti-companion in lots of ways. She kind of doesn't know how to act like a Doctor Who companion. She doesn't know how to run down a corridor. Like, she doesn't know what a Sontaran is. She's kind of, and that reflects what Catherine Tate was doing in the program.
She doesn't know what Doctor Who is.
That's right.
As she said.
So for the first time, we really have something which feels balanced in a way. And in this two-parter, you can see it happen again. One of them gets more prominence in one episode than the other. So it has such confidence this year of Doctor Who, I think.
She's the scabbard to the foil of Tennant, isn't she?
Yeah.
And she's the mirror of Tennant in, and I think the truth of Tennant. I think if Tennant was playing it truly, he'd be a lot more like Catherine Tate's performance. But again, we'll get to tropes and shtick later on. But I know who I'm favouring. I know who my eyes are watching on the screen when they're together.
Yeah. They have that chemistry, and it's also, it's sort of freed up a lot of it by not having to be a traditional doctor and companion sort of relationship.
And on a practical level, I think Catherine gets more B-plots and, if not an actual B-plot, more kind of relevance to the thematic qualities of the stories than Rose or Martha ever did.
For me, I think the big difference is that she is able to smack Tennant down. And one of the most annoying things about Tennant is how kind of bombastic he is. And one of Donna's roles is to constantly kind of puncture that balloon. You know, the sonic screwdriver doesn't do wood. You know,
that's one of the best delivered lines in the whole series. Whoa!
Like, she's constantly mocking him. She's constantly bringing him down. There's that scene earlier on this season where it looks like on their first meeting, Martha and Donna are going to fight, and David Tennant is clearly excited about the prospect of being fought over, and they just refuse to do it, and Donna kind of sort of smacks him down and just, you know, that's not going to happen. Here, I actually wonder whether Donna is, there's something about Donna's boredom and kind of impatience and stuff early on in this episode. So they arrive in the library and it's almost as if Donna isn't sort of interested in books.
But it's what we were just saying. She's what Johnny was just saying, as the anti-doctor. She was not a reader as a child. She's the non-fan in our fan production. So she's the outsider within the library. You can really see any fan child watching this. Oh my God, it's my head, it's my life, it's why I watch Doctor
Who. She doesn't know who Terence Dix is, does she?
She really doesn't. I don't believe she even mourned Peter. I don't believe she did.
And she also, she's sort of immune to all of the Doctor's shtick in a way that the other companions are not. Like, that has no effect on her because she has her own shtick. And really, she's the first companion allowed to be funny. and allowed to be charming true. In and of herself, not in combination with the Doctor. So it's unsurprising that she's probably not excited by the idea of following him around while he kind of sings beautifully about books. You know, like that's probably of no interest.
So does this mean that because the Doctor, the most Doctorish thing you can imagine is to be excited about being in a library, Donna's function is to be a bit bored in the background and want to wander over to the little shop?
I think too, though, she still manages to be as smart as the Doctor, and she is right about the books. So when the Doctor and her go up to the little computer terminal and discover that there's two human beings here, but a million other sort of living things, and she goes, it's not the books, is it? And it will turn out next episode, you know, in a very real sense it is. I mean, the Doctor will use that million number to describe the books next episode. Mm. So she's right. You know, it's we've had those relationships in Doctor Who before where if the Doctor and Donna disagree about something, Donna is right and the Doctor is wrong. And that's an unusual dynamic. I guess we probably had it with the Doctor and Romana.
Mm. I think that Donna's role is also to notice what the Doctor can't because he's too busy fighting the monsters and doing the heavy plot stuff. So it's her who kind of notices Miss Evangelista. It's her who's picking up on the weirdness of River Song in this. And so she plays a kind of I will pick up on the important stuff which you're letting drop to the floor.
The other thing about the Miss Evangelista thing is, of course, when Donna's character kind of gets rewritten to become a regular and where they kind of throw out some of her kind of more sort of abrasive personality. The big thing that they give her, which is present, I think, in Runaway Bride, is her compassion. Like the reason that she goes after Miss Evangelista is that everyone else is being mean to her, that they're leaving her out. Mm. And so Donna, you know, goes up and speaks to her. And then later when Miss Evangelista is ghosting, she refers to Donna as the kind woman, and Donna is almost embarrassed to say she means me. And it's almost impossible to imagine anyone calling Donna from The Runaway Bride the kind woman. Yeah. I think it's a really good rewrite. What they do for her character in Series 4 is amazing.
It's interesting that Moffat homes in on that because obviously we don't know what discussions happened between him and Russell and how much of this was explained, but we know that Moffat's scripts were not, as a rule, rewritten by Russell, and so the fact that Stephen goes in on this, and that is really Donna's defining characteristic in these episodes, is interesting that he picked up on that same thing.
Mm-hmm. I also thought, along the same lines, the fact that we have a little shop, which is just from New Earth. It's not a Moffat thing. It's not something that Russell has rewritten the episode to put in. I have a very strong feeling that Moffat likes Russell's Doctor Who a lot.
Absolutely. Does.
Yeah, like he's a big fan. And he continues to reference things from it in a really respectful way, even though he himself takes quite a different kind of approach.
There can't fail to be a mutual respect there. They're both at the top of their game, and writers know quality in other writers.
Yes. Mm. And respect difference, because it's the joy of opening and of getting your sheath out and ripping open those little French novels and going all the way through them. Yes, those proches. And
hidden in some depth of the library somewhere.
No, but it's the joy of it.
Accessed by special code. Or something.
Writing isn't ego. Talking about writing is all ego. Well, this is much like this podcast. But no, writing itself is egoless. All creativity is egoless. Your constructed self is somewhere up there in the cloud, just as your ideas are. I was talking about this to a friend yesterday who's a big creative force in Australian theatre and saying the same thing. It's just, no, I've been doing it all my life and I don't know where it comes from. That's the humbleness of creativity. It isn't you. So when you do get somebody's brilliant ideas that are not yours, it's a joyous childlike celebration. And that's why I love this story. There's a lot of levels in this story, but the main thing is, for me, this is about the isolated fan and growing up as a person who perhaps doesn't connect well with everyone else. And there's lots of layers of this, as we'll get to further down.
in the what section? Beyond bibliography. way at the back. Right at the bottom of our Dewey decimals.
There's a big sign out the window that says xenobiology that we see a shot of quite a lot. So way beyond there.
I do think we missed a trick from not having Donna being able to employ her knowledge of the Dewey decimal system at some point in this story.
That was disappointing, wasn't it? Yes.
Although it does link quite well with the previous story, which ends with a scene where the Doctor shows Donna a book from the year 5 billion, and then the dialogue in this episode after the cold open starts with the Doctor saying books, you know, people never ever get sick of books. Right. You know, there's holovids and was it fiction mist? Like all of these different things, but people come back down to books. And, you know, that speech, like everything in Moffat, gets a callback. The fact that it's physical paper books, you know, becomes important next episode.
I've been long prejudiced against this story for a long time and sort of biased against it because I... this really rare thing happened to me watching it, which is as soon as they show that bit at the beginning, which says 4,000 people saved, I kind of clicked and went, oh, right, they've been saved to a hard drive.
Right.
And then I had to do it, and I need to emphasize this never happens with me. I am absolutely hopeless at this. And so that terrible thing happens where you've clocked it early and you've got to wait for everyone to catch up. Everyone in the story to kind of catch up to it. So I've never enjoyed this story as much as I've enjoyed Moffat's other stories for the Russell T. Davies era. And so from the script's point of view, it always seems a little obvious to me, and it always has, and that's probably not being very fair to the story as a whole, because now when I come back to it, it looks like a really sophisticated piece of writing. And it actually, it's one of those rare things where the script has got better with time because we're all used to Doctor Who stories having continuity references in them, looking backwards at stories in the past. And watching in 2008, we didn't have that extra layer of meaning to bring to this, so we watch to it now, where we can see the future continuity references have played out really well. And so it actually becomes, and in particular, I think for the part of Riversong, the way that that's written, becomes so much richer now than watching it back in the day.
Yeah.
You can hear the grinding of the literary teeth of Paul Cornell saying,
that's my Benny.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. In fact, it has a real New Adventures feel to it.
Oh, yeah.
Thing, you know.
Cheeky Moffat.
Yeah. Well, I suppose a good idea is a good idea, right? Like a time-traveling archaeologist who likes to drink and likes to do the things the Doctor won't necessarily
is
do himself.
Someone else's idea. Yes. I agree.
Yeah, that's right.
I can see
that's
the piano. I'd be really nervous.
So that's a review of the script. It's plagiarism.
No, it's a characterization. Yes, I mean, look, we talked about this before. It's actually Scooby-Doo. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that Scooby-Doo villain that was a skeleton in a spacesuit.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
going back in the day. But it's also because he does read, he does like his psychoanalytical texts, Mr. Moff, and you can see that because he's still trying to work out who he is. Mm. And he's still trying to work out, dare I say, his relationship with women people.
Mm. Yeah.
And that comes across, and I think this is actually a really beautiful piece of writing, because the protagonists, the vulnerable, the ones that lead the narratives, the ones that actually perceive what's going on are all women. And some of them are very, very young women. Some of them are children.
Yeah.
And, in fact, the child turns out to be the one that is the instigator of not you know, jumping the shark till the second episode, but even in this story, it's the person who is the character who is actually understanding and leading the narrative is the observer. And it's one of the stories, it's why I like Moffat's stories, is that the Doctor, even though he may be the Deus Ex Machina, as you prefer to say, is it a machine? How do you say that in Latin?
Anyway, Deus Ex Machina.
Thank you. we aim to be true on this podcast. Is that he works best for me when he's the narrator. Mm. And he is not even a facilitator. Others around him show him how to be a better person, as Donna is doing in this one. But he's kind of really peripheral. He's just the sparkler on the side of the story. But it's – It's the movements within, it's the stories within the stories. I think this is probably the best defining metaphor for a Doctor Who story that's been in this new series run. Maybe we've had different ones that do it, but, you know, and but I think as directness and it goes quite deeply into feminine protagonists and how women are treated in narrative as well, but I'll talk about that next episode. Mm.
There's a lot to say about that in particular next episode, where we have kind of long stretches of time where the little girl is watching Doctor Who on television. Mm. You know, I mean, it sort of starts here, but that's a big element next week.
Well, not to give him too much kudos, of course, wasn't it Alfred the Pig did the same thing in Green Acres?
Green Acres is the place to
he
be.
Did.
It's so much to unpick there. And I think it's interesting what you said, Johnny, about Moffat's tropes being maybe a little bit more obvious than usual. And I wonder if that's a function of us becoming used to them and looking for something in the script, looking for the keyword or something that's not going to be what you think it is. Or I wonder if there's just too many tropes in this episode, because let's not forget that this story was broadcast less than 2 weeks after it was confirmed that Moffat was going to be the new showrunner.
Yeah.
Right. And so people were looking at this through a prism of that. And I think, although I do really like this story and I think there's great quality on display and I think it's a great example of proper adult Doctor Who, I think it's almost like a greatest hits of Moffat before the fact. And so there's so many Moffatian sort of things in there. So all of his big ticket ideas, be afraid of the dark because the shadows will kill you, the data ghosting, people have been saved, but there's no survivors, there's trees in a library. All of those really big ticket ideas, which would be the big thing in any other episode, he pours them in and packs them in. And actually it feels like it's a little bit wearing.
Do you know, I don't feel like that. I get that idea, you know, that it's like a Bob Baker and Dave Martin thing where, you know, every 30 seconds we've got another new sort of idea completely unrelated to all of the others.
I have Stephen Moffat's libel suit here. You're comparing him to Bob Baker and Dave Martin. He'll see you in court.
But he is obviously a much more skilled writer than them. And so I don't feel that the script is overstaffed. In fact, I think it gets it about right. And the sort of interesting things, you know, the other things that maybe you didn't mention that are sort of very Moffat-y are the idea of sort of levels of narrative and the relationship between the narrator and the story. In particular, the idea that if there's a narrator, their story will eventually catch up with them and they'll become involved in the story that they're telling. And so here you have, right from the cold open, you've got the idea that the Doctor and Donna are the imaginations of a child. So there's a child in a normal contemporary house, maybe even a little bit earlier. There's a very kind of sort of 1980s style sort of telephone and stuff. She is just sort of a normal child in a contemporary setting. But when she closes her eyes, she goes to the place where the Doctor and Donna appear. And that incredibly strange moment where the Doctor and Donna start interacting with her, like they notice her and start interacting with her just before the opening credits. Mm. And, you know, she wakes up and then replaying that scene again later in the episode. And we see that what the Doctor and Donna actually saw was that sort of football, that security camera. A sort of wooden monopticon. And what Dr. Moon says, like Dr. Moon, in those scenes, initially Dr. Moon says, you realize the library's in your head and that this is the real world. And then just before the cliffhanger, and I think it's the most impressive part of the cliffhanger, is that terrifying speech where, no, this world is a lie and the things that you have nightmares about, those are real. And so those different levels of reality, like, did you spot that, Johnny? I mean, you spotted that saved meant saved to a hard drive. Did you spot that the girl's real world was actually VR that was taking place in the same computer?
I don't know if I spotted it per se, but I just kind of read it that way.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't think there was anything to spot in that. Like, I just sort of assumed that that's what was going on. But it's interesting what you say about trying to turn the characters into fiction, trying to turn the Doctor and Donna into fiction. So she's watching it through television. We get this sense of people watching Doctor Who on television in front of us in a kind of Trial of a Time Lord kind of way. And it's, I'm not sure what it means though. Like, I'm not sure why we want to point out the fiction of it at this point.
It's a Moffat thing though, isn't it? Like, Moffat is very, very much not creating a coherent world for the Doctor to have adventures in the way that Russell does do. Like, Russell creates a coherent world where the Cybermen all have, you know, like a story and all of that sort of thing, and everything follows. And I love that. Do you know what I mean? That's the sort of world that a 12-year-old watching Doctor Who absolutely adores, whereas Moffat is super aware of the fictionality of the premise. And so he will do things like reset the universe at the end of Series 5 and have it recreated through the power of stories and stuff. You know, that's a very, very Moffat thing.
One of my favourite things is going back to Edwardian children's fiction, which Doctor Who is just the natural inheritor of. But the story of being in a library, in your head in a library, is pure British children's storytelling.
And in fact, you know, the outside of the library is this sort of fabulous futuristic but slightly deco kind of city. And then inside the library is, you know, wood panelling and all of that sort of thing.
It's the safe place for fan children to go to get away from the sports field at school.
Yeah, this is, I think, another level. We were talking about the fan experience earlier. Moffat is not only interested in the way that TV is presented and consumed, he's also interested in the fan experience. And so what could be more fan than a young child watching the adventures of Doctor and Donna on screen, closing their eyes and being back there?
And what could be more fan than the need to hide and even the touching on, and this is where Moffat's depths can't be underestimated, the spectrums that a lot of us fans have, and that need for isolation and not quite cluing into other people's emotions, how others connect, but being able to do so through a medium of, say, in this case, a library.
Can we take that even further and say that as a child, your world was being surrounded by all those brilliant Doctor Who novelizations?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, the library is not alien territory for the people watching this avidly. In fact, there were two things going on as a fan. You were watching it on television and then you were going to the local library to look for the books so that you could relive the experience. I really like this idea, but that what he's doing is mirroring the kind of fan experience of it. And if I think about what this story is about, I think primarily it seems to me about the power of relationships and friendships and about how we need people around us. But maybe in sort of trying to explore the fictionality of Doctor Who, maybe what it's also saying kind of above just, hey, aren't books awesome? You know, aren't stories awesome? But maybe is that the imagination is a kind of sacred kind of place. It's a child's imagination is a kind of locked off, safe place for kids, which needs to be preserved and needs to be cherished.
It's definitely a place. Yes, thank you, Johnny. It's the place.
That's all right,
it's the place. Well, no, because it's what I was going to touch on with Miss Evangelista later on. The place of safety, and for a young child, in this case a female young child, who needs to find. I'll throw something up. Did anyone else find a chill in this episode when Miss Evangelista is introduced and she said, I'm his Miss Everything. I'm his assistant at everything.
Well, you reckon that...
I'm going to go further with this because it does. It actually talks about the safety of the individual and the safety of the small child in this. Mm.
If we're talking about Miss Evangelista, I think there's something kind of low-level problematic about her character in this episode. And remember, she has got a very different story next episode. But it's partly to do with that line, which I think might get a blue line through it these days.
Yeah.
It was right at the time when things were starting to come out.
Yeah. And it's also... She's a bimbo. She's named after a supermodel.
Yeah.
And she's kind of low-level bullied by everyone else around her. Yes. I'm just not sure you would put that character on screen.
I think it's the same reason that J.K. Rowling writes Potter's actual father as a bully. It's the same reason that Moffat looks at his own behaviour as being one of the smartest kids at school and remembering how he treated the people in the group. Because I think if we look back, there are very few of us who did not treat other children like that, who we've read did not come to our level.
Yeah, I think too that she is like a child in that she's she talks about her father. You know, she doesn't seem to have sort of like adult relationships. She's not overtly sort of sexual. She's pretty, but she's not described as sexy or anything like that. And she does that thing, the wandering off. You know, a door opens, it's irresistible to her. She goes off exploring to see what's happening. She is a little bit like the protagonist of a children's story. But I do also think that the reason that she's bullied, and she is bullied in a way that doesn't make us like Anita or other Dave any less. She's bullied in a way, and I guess I think it's her kind of obliviousness to that. Like she doesn't understand the nasty things that people are saying about her. She gets that she's being bullied.
But I would say we all do when she cites the kind woman. Yeah. I want to speak to the kind person. Everybody knows, every animal knows they're genuineness or other of your intent.
Yeah. It's quite a sophisticated take on bullying as well, because yes, they are bullying her. That's absolutely what's happening. But you can really see why they're not bullying her because she says she's pretty. They're not bullying her because they view her as being something less than themselves. It's because she keeps doing annoying things.
And, you know, Moffat's making her do that. You know, Moffat's making her go to the escape capsule instead of the bathroom or whatever. Like, he puts those details in where she is kind of really stupid. Mm. And I wonder whether the thing is that Moffat takes the most cartoonish of the characters there, which is Miss Evangelista. I think that she's so stupid that she doesn't get the plankton remark, you know, and she's ditzy and sort of funny and stuff. And then making her the person that we... Like, her death is one of the most affecting deaths, I think, in the history of Doctor Who.
Miss Evangelista with maybe the candlestick in the library.
Let's not forget.
I guess my point is, should she have been a man? Like, to avoid that whole treatment of that character in that particular way, a gender swap might have been the easiest way out of it.
I'm glad you went there, because it's deliberate. And even the notion of evangelical or ascendant or transcendent is in the name, as well as the supermodel thing. No, she's a woman. And let's not underestimate Moffat's depth. I'm seeing imposter syndrome. A person will behave gullibly and stupidly and awkwardly when they are told they're no good. And you can tame a child from a very, very early age to be told they're stupid. Now, she has enormous amounts of empathy. As psych now reads, is actually a higher form of intelligence than IQ. So all of that is there. But to be told you're an idiot all your life, that's why I love that line of, they think I'm stupid because I'm pretty, because all I have consciously is my face. Because everything else is derided, but my face is the reason this man has hired me and I am his factotum as Miss Everything. I really do think it gets as dark as that.
Mrs. Spandrel says hi, by the way, and she has something to throw in at this point.
Yeah.
She wandered past the television as I was watching it. She said, the scene which you describe as heartbreaking, the scene where she dies, and I agree, it's tragically written, all that bit about, if you know, don't tell them I said that stuff about me being stupid. But as Mrs. Spandrel said, that device of the last thing that she hears is the thing which lingers in her mind right towards the death. As the sort of thing, it's a warning really to be careful about what you say to people.
Yeah.
Because you never know if it's going to be the last thing they hear and if it's going to ring in their ears at the moment of their passing. So
yeah, in fact, Moffat does shame those people. Like,
oh yeah,
he has them standing there listening to her talk about what they've said about her and what they think of her. So they are embarrassed by the way that they've treated her. Can we talk about this? Because there is this thing that Moffat has about death, you know, that's a big thing that's coming up all throughout his era and kind of rubbing our noses in the fact of death. Now, people complain that Moffat brings people back to life and all of that sort of thing, but, you know, the don't cremate me thing in Dark Water, the, you know, what happens to Danny Pink in that same episode. We saw Dracula earlier this year, and Dracula is all about what happens to you when you die. And here, having us forced to watch her die slowly in a completely kind of PG, non-gory way, but nevertheless an absolutely heartbreaking and terrifying way where her thoughts break down. She's no longer able to think, like her brain has disappeared and all that's left is this sort of degrading memory pattern. I just find it absolutely chilling, like utterly terrifying. And the fact that people turn into, you know, your death, at the time of your death, you'll turn from a person into an object, you know, that you don't think you, no one has quite the same moral responsibilities towards you as they did before. You know, your wishes and things, your plans, your hopes all vanish from the earth at that point. And so turning her into this sort of data ghost that's just eventually just repeating nonsense. And, you know, Anita says the same thing about her grandfather, who just ends up spending a day obsessing about his shoelaces. And that does happen to people's grandfathers. Do you know what I mean? Even now, even without that technology, that's what happens to us. And so Russell does that thing in Cucumber Episode 6 where he forces us to live through Lance's death from Lance's point of view. And again, I find that one of the most horrifically scary things that I've ever seen on television. And this, I think, is like that. I think it's incredible. And the fact that it's not just done for a cheap trick, it's how we solve the problem at the end, but it really is incredibly good.
Can I offer a slightly different reading to that as well?
Yeah.
It is concerned with death, and Moffat is concerned with the experience of death and living. How about Alzheimer's parable?
Yeah, well, that's what,
because
I think.
Because we had the, you know, the grandfather who, you know, became consumed with tying his shoelaces. Miss Evangelista's data ghosting is about the breakdown of her mind in sort of real time until she's left with nothing but repeating herself. Next episode, we'll have Donna consistently finding herself in new and unfamiliar circumstances and having to be reminded who people are and that kind of thing. And then there's River, who's someone who she's got someone who she knows, but who doesn't know her. And it's heartbreaking. Wow.
Let's talk more about River and the Doctor.
I'll talk about River because, yeah, she's definitely Benny Summerfield. She's also a kind of souped up Romana as well too.
Again, and, like Benny.
And I think that, you know, we were talking about how Moffat approaches female characters, and River's another example of this enigmatic woman who's a puzzle that the Doctor has to solve. And I find that a little bit wearing.
Yeah. I find it an advent calendar into Moffat's ideal woman, and the handcuffs coming out at Stephen. I don't need to unpack this with you every time you write a woman that you actually find attractive.
But I think that Alex Kingston's terrific in it, and I think she's really watchable, and I think it's a great character. Mm. But it's more about how we keep seeing that repeat over and over again, that you do wonder why we're positioning the female characters in Doctor Who in that way.
It is all of his major female characters, isn't it? It's Amy, it's, you know, most Clara. Obviously Clara.
It's Julia Sawala in Press Gang.
Yeah.
It's Sally Renette. Sparrow having to be kind of unpicked emotionally. Yeah.
But, I mean, he does it in Coupling as well. Mm. And the idea is that the women are hyper-competent because the men are so useless, and River will take on the role of kind of deflating the Doctor whenever he does something massively stupid, like shooting the Fez and the Stetson and stuff. Like, you know, like, no, that you're a stupid man, stop doing that. And she does it a bit here too, because she knows more than the Doctor about their relationship. She's the one who is on the front foot, and the Doctor is kind of clueless. And one of the things that both of Moffat's doctors are is thoughtless kind of man-children, you know, like people who are oblivious to the effect that they have on other people around them. Moffat's very, very first sitcom is called Joking Apart, and it is partly autobiographical. It's about the breakup of his first marriage. And all the way through, we're told that the ex-wife character was responsible for the breakup because she had an affair, and he's aggrieved that he's been cheated on, until it really becomes clear throughout that first series. And the second series is absolutely embarrassing and you shouldn't watch it at all. But the first series, it becomes clear that the reason that she left is that Moffat was an insufferable smart ass. And both of his doctors are like that. And so
he has no one to blame but himself.
No, but he's working through that. He's clearly acknowledging that. And so although he has a sort of rather essentialist way of presenting these sort of female characters, what he is examining just as much is what's wrong with masculinity, I think.
I think there's another thing that this season is doing, which is constantly trying to wrong foot the Doctor, like throwing in new elements all the time. Give him a daughter, put him on a space bus full of psychopaths and see what happens.
Yeah.
And it's a way, it's in a response to Tennant's kind of his own kind of uber confidence and uber competence, you know. So let's give him a wife and see what happens. Mm. I think that River here in this story is there's a kind of reading this story if you were a really old school fanboy and didn't like the idea of the Doctor having a wife. You could read this as River as a future companion. Like, she does a range of sort of companion-like activities. Yeah. Whereas later, as she develops, she becomes much more a sort of alternative Doctor. She becomes much more kind of doing the sort of things the Doctor would do only better. You know, she's sexier, she'll shoot a gun, she'll do all these.
She'll fly the TARDIS properly.
Yeah, right. She doesn't put the handbrake on.
So I think at the moment there's this one thing of just trying to throw in an element to twist the whole thing into a new and different way. But it's also in a way playing a little safe this episode with River. Maybe that's because it's a kind of gradual thing and you've got to start small.
I think next week it is 100% certain that they are husband and wife. I think there's absolutely no doubt that, and we'll talk about
you
next
even have
week.
That scene.
Yeah, I'll talk about next week when I think that becomes absolutely clear. But they are clearly in a romantic relationship, you know, very clearly. When Paul Cornell first wrote Human Nature, he said that one of the things that he missed, or one of the costs that story imposed on the show, was making the Doctor heterosexual. And he was aware that the Doctor's kind of lack of interest in women may have been responsible for the big kind of following that the program had, you know, among gay fans. I mean, there's a camp sensibility to the show and all of that sort of thing. But the fact that the Doctor isn't a romantic leading man it was a thing that appealed to us, and that made him different from other heroes in other stories. But, you know, by series four, that ship sailed. You know, so there's nothing to lose, I think, by giving him a wife. And just as a weird thing last night, I watched The Husbands of River Song last night because that's the end of that River Song arc. And I think that the sort of marriage relationship that the two of them are depicted as having doesn't break the program at all. And that's one of the things, another thing that Moffat will do is that he will do things that look like they're going to change the program enormously. There's another Doctor, you know, the Doctor, his death planet we know about, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And in fact, it makes no difference. The show goes on.
And we have had this relationship before with the fourth Doctor and Romana.
Yeah.
They are husband and wife Time Lord in space with the dog, and later they get the kid.
So true. And then it all goes to him.
Such a disappointment.
It could have only been
them.
More perfect if David Tennant, Alex Kingston, had got married in real life.
Rather than marrying his own daughter, let's not go there. It's too Trumpian.
It would have been lovely if there'd been a Doctor and River special the following year, if one of those four, if we could have seen them normalized in that way.
I'm hoping we get one with Jodie.
I wonder whether the whole arc is spoiled a little bit by the fact that this is the only time that that River meets David Tennant's doctor. Like, you know, the next time they meet in the Crash of the Byzantium, it's someone else. But I kind of have this sort of thing where she doesn't really know what order the doctors come in and doesn't really care. That's my thing. And that beautiful thing where she's looking at him and going, you are so young. And he does, you know, I'm not, you know. Mm. And then he's wrong, you know.
You see, I quite like the fact that you only get the one with David Tennant. She's looking at him saying, you're so young, because the bulk of her adventures with the Doctor have been with the 11th, Matt Smith.
Mm.
But then she has one with the 12th, Peter Capaldi. Then she has David Tennant, and she's looking at him and saying, you're so young, after she's just spent 24 years with the 12th Doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I also like to think that she can't remember what any of them look like until she actually turns up and sees them. She's the sort of fan who goes, was that a Matt Smith story or a David Tennant story? I can't remember the one that happened
in. There's a great moment in Husbands of River Song where she drops one of those card wallets with the sort of concertina cards, and she has like publicity photos of all of the doctors in it. And she's sort of checking off Capaldi against it. No, he's not there.
Wouldn't you have paid good money to see the special with the sixth doctor back with River Song? Yeah. That would have worked wonderfully.
Sixth doctor, I want to see the CG version with Pat Trout and could get frisky.
Let's go back to Billy. I mean, Peter Cushing.
Jolly good smacked bottom.
We've talked a little bit about the sort of virtual reality aspect of the plot, but the one thing that we haven't talked about is the actual monsters.
Well, we're back to Moffat, aren't we, playing with his psych tropes, because the monsters are our shadows, and most of the story is about owning our shadows and what happens when we don't. And then there's a lovely bit of environmental truth thrown on, but that's for later, not for here.
I also think it is his thing where, you know, he thinks that the real place that Doctor Who takes place is under your bed, and here he makes something very, very common very terrifying.
Yeah.
I think they're terrific, and I think it's really brought home in the shots with the chicken leg that they throw into the... It's all done through editing, I imagine.
Yeah.
It's really, really effective. You instantly know what the threat is, and he's been holding off telling you for about 30 minutes in that story, so it's about time he kind of demonstrated what it was.
Do you notice how begrudging Elder Dave is in handing over his chicken leg, by the way? He's really annoyed that he's not going to have that chicken leg for lunch at the Fashion Narada.
So they come in two forms, these monsters. They come in the shadows, and they come in the skeleton spacesuit things.
Yeah.
And the skeletons in the spacesuits are a terrific image. They look fantastic. And yet there's something kind of contrived about them, because it means that the crew have to keep putting their helmets back on and keep finding reasons to put their helmets back on and dimming them. So there's, you know, there's a bit of hand waving about, well, maybe it'll make it harder for them to digest you. But so it's a little bit, I find, and also once they're in the spacesuits, I'm not sure what they can actually do to you. Like, at one stage, one of them pushes hard down on David Tennant's shoulders. But it's not like we ever see anyone come to their end at the hands of the Vashti Narada in that
way. Why are they running in terror from them in that form?
Well, yeah, that's right.
But
very slowly running from them in that form.
Aren't there scenes where the spacesuit is standing there and these shadows are emanating out of it? And
yeah, so we could have just had the shadows. We don't actually need the spacesuits for that bit. But it feels so churlish to even say that, because they're such great monsters. They look fantastic and they're terrific, but they are a little bit of window dressing, I think.
Do you think that they are a little bit kind of playing on the ambassadors of death iconography as well? They are terrifyingly spacesuited things without even the gimmick of a skeleton, and all they have to do is touch you. I think they're amazingly effective, and they have to be kind of high up on Moffat's list of memories of Doctor Who.
Well, he'll return to this as well, won't he, in The Impossible Astronaut and Day of the Moon, where he again uses it as a thing of otherness, something in a spacesuit, be it a little girl or be it something rising from a lake.
Yeah.
It goes back a long way. We have men in diving suits in 30s and 40s Universal things. We have gosh, what else? All of the SF tropes of well, there's the mask. There's the horror behind the mask, and the notion that the full skin hides who we are both ways. We can hide it from ourselves inside it, and others cannot see who we are.
I think it's lucky though the Vashtinirada have a particular preference for supporting characters.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
that was kind of it's the usual thing of the backing off when they know his name. Just eat him; he's right there.
I think you'll find that all Doctor Who monsters have that particular predilection.
But there's an in-universe reason for that, because the regulars are smart enough to keep away from them and stay out of the shadows and do as the Doctor says.
If I was one of the crew, though, I'd keep my helmet off at all times. So I'd say this is clearly the way to not get eaten. I'll just leave my helmet off, thanks very much.
Does this go to a death comes to time? I'm sorry, I had to raise it at some point in the bloody shenanigans of this lovely podcast, but is there something about the knowledge of the word or the truth of the word, which is quite Kabbalistic, and we go back to writers like Jorge Luis Borges, which is, you know, the world is actually built on words. It's an okay thing to bring up, since this is a story about words.
Well, there is that big library, you know, like that's clearly where that comes from, a library that's the size of the world, that's absolutely vast.
If you want power over the Doctor, you need only speak one word.
Yeah.
If you want to raise the Gollum from a mountainous effigy of clay to wreak havoc against your oppressors, you write the secret Kabbalistic name of God on a bit of paper and pop it in its mouth. Mm. I'm talking about the Gollum, not
Sidrus and Andy Serkis
in a suit.
We go back to Shakespeare Code and the power of words the Doctor Who universe. They, you know, words are responsible for creating worlds. And in the Doctor universe, it's words and mathematics. They are the universe, aren't they? They're the building blocks.
Well, the higher thinkers amongst us, you know, the folk that are actually working down at the synchrotron, like our friend Jason, fan of the podcast, hello, will say the same thing, that mathematics are the building blocks of the universe and words are simply symbols of the same thing. Oh, it gets deep on this, doesn't it, Johnny?
Jeez.
I just wanted to talk about, you know, little things eating people, swarms of things.
Well, you've got dogs.
It is that sort of perfect thing where it is designed to scare the hell out of small children.
It doesn't it?
and it creates a playground game where you're all standing around in the playground not trying to cross one another's shadows, not letting the shadows touch. You know, your shadow is infected with this thing. All of that is perfect.
Doesn't Moffat – well, actually, I think writers that worked with Moffat in later seasons said his starting point was always, what's the playground game?
Yeah, right. Well, this absolutely has it. And those shadows things, there's that one fabulous moment. One thing that Moffat does is there'll be something in plain sight and then you'll realize that its presence is terrifying. And so there's one of them next week, just a brief one, but this week it's, you know, they're in the room in the library which has a hole in the roof or a sort of cupola made of glass or something, and there's a giant shadow on the floor, and then the Doctor suddenly says, but what's casting it? You know, like he just takes ordinary things like shadows or motes of dust in a sunbeam and turns them into monsters.
Isn't that a great throwaway line?
Isn't it great? Yeah. Superb. Mm. And just saying, they're everywhere. We have them on Earth. You know, you could be eaten by the Vashtinirada. And it's not quite as on the nose as the sort of fabulous montage of various sort of statues and stuff about the place at the end of Blink. But I think for a kid, it's even more terrifying. I think these monsters are among the best that Doctor Who's ever done, just conceptually.
Am I misremembering that in that very first wide shot where they come back into the library and the TARDIS is there, that
yes,
you are seeing the dust in the light?
Yeah. Can we talk about the production too? Because the locations, we slammed
The Doctor's Daughter
2 weeks ago. Like, we slammed that for the poor quality of the production, but here the locations are absolutely incredible. The CGI city looks great.
Beautiful.
And Murray Gold is just killing it this week.
Yeah, he does a great job. And I think it's on the death of one of the Daves. I'm sure there's a bit of space adventure in that music. I'm sure if you hear it, you can go to dom 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 dom. I think it is a beauty. It does look beautiful, this episode, and I think everyone's really playing at the top of their game for this one.
Didn't Moffat miss a trick for the 50th anniversary, bringing him back, the Dave of the Doctor? No. All right. Eros Lynn does a wonderful job.
Yeah. He's a terrific director.
He is absolutely really terrific. And he understands what goes on the screen. He understands the power of large images to which he lingers on, like those shots in the library, to create the atmosphere of the story.
Mm. I think he's also a flourishy kind of director too, you know, so he'll do kind of tilted angles. There's lots of colour in his shots all the time. Mm. He's not an understated kind of director, and yet he's great at pace, he's great at action. He's really, I think, kind of one of the unsung heroes of the first 4 years of the program, like, yeah. Does he do more episodes than anyone else? I don't know.
He doesn't, but actually, if you look at his progress, he starts off just doing everyday episodes, and then as he goes on throughout Russell's era, he starts to do the big episodes. So he does Christmas, and then he does a big two-parter, and then he ends up doing David Tennant's Swan Song. So he comes back for all of the important beats, and let's not forget that after that terrible the experience of the first production block in Christopher Eccleston's year, he came on board for episode 2 and 3 and he righted the ship.
Mm. Yeah.
He made everything right.
Mm.
So we get so few cliffhangers these days, and so they can't merely be, you know, someone walking in saying kill him or anything like that. This one, I just think, is an incredible whole series of events. Mm. You know,
he was the Doctor all the time.
Well, you know, we've got Donna screaming in the TARDIS and disappearing.
One of the best screams in New Who.
Yeah,
that is
chilling.
True.
Yeah, yeah, and we don't know what's happening. We literally have no idea what's happening there.
And a clever choice of visual effect to make it look like she's being dissolved. So you might think the Vashti Narada have her. Like, yeah. She doesn't just teleport away. She kind of gets eaten away by that visual effect. Mm. And it's a nice sleight of hand, I think.
And then I think in retrospect, it looks like a TV image kind of flickering out, yeah, a little true. Bit. So there's something computery about it, which, you know, is what happens. And we get Dr. Moon's speech about the real world not being real. We get, you know, proper Dave menacing them, and then we get Donna. And Donna on the node, like on that statue thing. And again, you know how we were talking about death before? You know, like
usual,
there's a bank of dead flesh that produces those. So the fact that she appears on that thing means that she's dead, you know, as far as we're concerned.
Mm.
And then just that one moment just before the closing credits go in where she blinks, like, check it out the next time. At the very end, she delivers her Donna Noble has been saved line and then just blinks very slowly.
Like, there's a pause that's not there in any other kind of shot of her saying that. Yeah.
I will say that, you know, because I sort of came to this pre-spoiled in a way by the first few minutes of it, which is very apt, I suppose, in a spoiler-ish. It's constantly warning about spoilers. Her lines towards the end of that episode are, Donna Noble has been saved.
So you.
Donna Noble, I'm going, yeah, I know. I know you keep telling me this and I know it already.
Yeah.
So it is kind of, but it is where I agree about the cliffhanger is that the sequence of events leading up to it is masterful. Like, it is absolutely played with the right beats at the right time.
Yeah, you don't have that many cliffhangers. And, you know, that very, very first cliffhanger that the new series of Doctor Who ever does, which is just everyone in every plot, subplot gets attacked by Slitheen all at once. I mean, that's great, and it does mean that we've got more people in peril than we might have had otherwise, and Jackie in peril, obviously, which makes it sort of extra effective.
But too many shots.
Yeah.
They haven't worked out how to build to a climax in a cliffhanger.
But here there's different things. There's peril, there's Donna's dead, perhaps, there's a complete kind of upending of the relationship between the framing story and the main story or whatever. You know, all of that stuff is happening. It's conceptual, it's proper terror, and it's, you know, Moffat catchphrases. In fact, dueling Moffat catchphrases, in fact.
Yeah. I think another part of it that works, and if you're a young child, I think this is effective, is the Doctor is absolutely helpless at the moment. Mm. He's standing on a pile of books trying to make the lights work. You know, like, he has no answer. And the thing is coming towards him. There's a real – and as we'll see next week, he still doesn't have an answer.
Mm.
So it is kind of – I think that would be frightening if you were a child watching it and your confidence in this Doctor may have been shaken over this episode.
Well, dear listener, that skeleton in a spacesuit isn't going to flee itself, so we're all going to leg it down this corridor in search of somewhere with some nice, safe fluorescent lighting. We'll be back next week, we hope, for Forest of the Dead. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FDE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jody into Terror. Where can people find you, Johnny?
You can find me on Twitter at Johnny Spandrel, and you can read my blog at randomhoonis.com.
You can also find him in the Castellan's office on Gallifrey.
Snort.
All right. Until next time, remember, if you want to live, for God's sake, count the shadows. Message ends. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Oh, you can probably find me on a park bench somewhere, you know. Just, you know, send me a text.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths, Johnny Spandrel and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, No One to Blame But Himself, was recorded on the 23rd of February 2020 and released on the 3rd of May. Here at FDE Publications, we're about to release a series of novelisations of some of our earlier episodes, including FDE and the Giant Cake, FDE and the 8-hour recording session, and FDE and Why the Hell Won't Nathan Shut Up About the Massacre.
Again, I'm just coming back to, this is not a story about science fiction or Doctor Who. It's about interpersonal relationships and actually our relationship with the outside world as individual fans and our vulnerability in that world.
But I do think that in spite of that, it actually functions on the level of just a science fiction adventure story incredibly well.
It's really superb. Yeah. I know we get kind of do say that a lot. Maybe it's just this era, but I'm really
not
kidding.
It's why we love this show, because it is often superb.
Just, you know, since I'm sitting with Peter, but I haven't enjoyed a story so much since Daleks in Manhattan.
Another classic.
After Sontaran two-parter, didn't that look better in retrospect?
Yeah.
Well, it was funny. We were all, I don't know if you heard that, Johnny, we were all sitting around last year doing our Daleks in Manhattan retrospective. No one looked at me. You can't, because again, for radio, faces for radio, everyone looked at me like I dropped the chine. I said, I love this story.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you on Daleks in Manhattan. It's I just think gone. It's actually, yeah. It's
but I love New York at that time. So, yeah. But again, there's that sense of people coming together and solving things in that great, you know, Pip, Dunkirk, you know, never, isn't it a shame we haven't any toilet paper way of approaching the world? We'll just manage.
I think it's lucky though, the vast.